Welcome and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. Surprise billing continues to dominate the healthcare headlines in Washington, with the House taking a big first step in advancing its surprise billing legislation. This week, we recap the Energy and Commerce Health Subcommittee's markup hearing on the No Surprises Act and get an update on where the Senate surprise billing legislation is in its process. We also debrief the Federal Appeals Court oral arguments in the Texas v. U.S. case challenging the constitutionality of the ACA and look ahead to next week's expected vote to repeal the ACA's Cadillac tax. Before we begin, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify, and to rate us. The podcast is posted every Friday on these platforms ahead of being distributed through NAHU's member-exclusive health policy newsletter, The Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour. The big whoop this week is a subcommittee markup hearing on the No Surprises Act to stop the practice of surprise medical billing by implementing a federal benchmarking standard. Can you remind us of the key components of this legislation and recap how the hearing went down and the next steps in the process?
So surprise billing continues to be the hottest healthcare topic in Washington, D.C. right now. This week, Chairman Pallone of the Energy and Commerce Committee and Ranking Member Walden have introduced legislation that NAHU strongly endorsed that has this benchmark rate that we think will help keep cost down. And it's more narrow than everything the Senate bill was doing. It's very just trying to deal with the issue of surprise billing.
So all eyes are on Energy and Commerce Committee, Subcommittee on Health, that held a hearing yesterday on surprise billing. And of course, the contentious aspect of the legislation is this issue about how surprise billing will be mitigated. Will it be a negotiated geographic region baseline, or will it be some form of arbitration? And that's kind of where the dividing line is between providers who are four square behind arbitration and everybody else who prefers a different method.
And in the markup, they were actually looking at several bills, and the markup meeting lasted several hours, about 3 or 4 hours, and this was only one section of this. Some of the other bills were a lot more contentious, with amendments being presented from the floor in the meeting, but this was one area where no amendments were offered, but there was a lot of discussion about the fact that Energy and Commerce decided with their legislation to go with introducing a bill that included benchmarking as that process to try to determine how to manage surprise billing instead of arbitration. And there were a few members of the subcommittee that were very vocal in their support of arbitration. Dr. Bouchon from Indiana was one of them, as well as Representative Shimkus saying that his state of Illinois has been doing this for over 9 years using arbitration, and they felt like their system was tried and true and was a good example, where others on the committee, like Pallone and others, were saying that some of the arbitration methods that they've seen in the states, they didn't believe had really been around long enough to really prove whether it was a good process through which the system of alleviating surprise bills should be going. And he cited states like California and New Jersey. So a little disagreement on whether folks were seeing the arbitration styles in different states as actually being successful. But as Representative Pallone pointed out, they did release a discussion draft of their legislation several months ago, and it included the benchmarking and asked for feedback on arbitration and other systems. And he really felt that as chair of ENC, that was the opportunity for these representatives to respond on the arbitration issue versus benchmarking, and that moving forward, they were going to stick with the benchmarking process because they had already received comments from others through the discussion draft system, and this is what was decided on.
So benchmarking actually saves money, according to the Congressional Budget Office. And so that's a huge factor here.
With arbitration, we are concerned about having a negative impact on the market and actually increasing the cost of premiums and also increasing the cost to employers and individuals if they do receive a balance bill and have to go through arbitration, the cost of having to hire an attorney to do that and then still being left with a balance bill at the end of the arbitration system. So still being on the hook for a higher cost of care than compared to if we went through the benchmarking system, which of course does not rely on the cost of attorneys and going through arbitration, but would also kind of cap the amount that providers could charge in a balance bill. So then there's already a limit to how much they could charge. And if a patient is given a surprise bill or a balance bill, it is going to be already mitigated down to the cap of what a typical healthcare provider offering the same treatment in that geographic area would charge.
110 million of the 180 million or so who are in employer-sponsored coverage self-insure. And so the bill was everyone is saying, well, we want to hold harmless consumers and that. But what they're really not being held harmless here. They're being held harmless from receiving a physical bill in the mail for $50,000 or whatever it is. But in the form of copays and higher deductibles will be still a financial hit to even those in self-insured plans, because self-insured plans pay the full amount of the bill. And, you know, if providers are allowed to spin the wheel and try to hit the jackpot for more later, then that's just added cost that is otherwise diverted. And as Marcy said, the prospect of another issue around, you know, they already have issues around compliance issues that are costing them a lot of money. And now to have to lawyer up for this is just another added burden at a time when discussion about Medicare for all, you will want to keep employers in the game and not disrupt that market.
So the bill did ultimately pass out of the health subcommittee, and it will go to a full Energy and Commerce Committee markup, possibly within the next couple of weeks. We are very supportive of this piece of legislation, and again, the use of benchmarking as the prospect to help to mitigate surprise billing, balance billing to consumers. We also engaged our Operation Shout system and asked you all to send messages to members of Congress in support of this legislation, which I think was very helpful when the members of Congress were in this markup and able to use some of the points that we provided in those letters to members of Congress. And we also sent a support letter to the subcommittee, and it was read into the record. So we are on record supporting the benchmarking prospect from the Energy and Commerce bill.
What is unusual about this exercise going on in Energy and Commerce is that Mr. Walden, the ranking member, is completely supportive of what the chairman is doing. And so I think that United Front is helping.
We expect the Ways and Means Committee and the Education and Labor Committee, who have done hearings on surprise billing, also to be working on their own pieces of legislation.
In Education and Labor, Mr. Rowe, Dr. Rowe from Tennessee on the Republican side, is a strong proponent of arbitration and has a very vocal platform within that committee and can be influential. So it's hard to say where that committee of jurisdiction might go on this, but I think they're going to kind of follow the lead of Energy and Commerce.
There is a big push to see if we can get that done this summer. This has been a big priority of the Trump administration. It's a big priority of the senators and Speaker Pelosi. So it's one of these rare areas that you don't see a very D versus R, conservative versus liberal. It is really just about the approach of how to solve the surprise billing. There's less ideology on this issue than we've seen in other areas.
And you all can help us with this. We will be continuing to engage on our Operation Shout system as this bill makes its way through the House legislative process. So please keep an eye out on social media for some of the messages that we send out there. Retweet, like them. And when you see an Operation Shout coming into your email, just take the time to put your zip code in and send that message to your member of Congress.
Well, the House bill continues to make its way through the legislative process. Chris, can you give us an update on where the bill is moving in the Senate?
Previously, we spoke about the HELP subcommittee passing a large bill, including issues around surprise billing, issues of broker commission disclosures, and others. That piece of legislation continues to move forward. In fact, the Republicans right now are using this process called the hotline, where they see if they could pass the bill through the U.S. Senate by unanimous consent. And so they're checking with each of the offices now to try to fish out who might have a problem with passing this piece of legislation completely on the Senate floor.
This is the same process by which we were able to get the PACE Act passed.
Correct. They often use this tool for a couple different reasons, to pass anything quickly that the senators all agree on. But the process can also be used to see who really has true problems with the piece of legislation, because you have to identify yourself as being for or against the piece of legislation, almost similar to a vote without actually having a vote. And so now this allows the process to move forward. So we expect to see this process, particularly amongst the Republicans in the U.S. Senate, come through quickly. We did a meeting with the Senate Help Committee staff, continuing to offer our assistance with them on the issue of surprise billing.
So in the bill that I referenced that we have seen this happen with before, where we were very successful, the PACE Act was the bill that would allow states to determine whether their small group would go from 50 to 100. And we saw most of the states stayed at 50 and a few decided to set their small group at 100 plus and instead of going below that. But this was an instance where we found out there were two holds on the bill that would have prevented unanimous consent. And we contacted Senator Scott, and he pounded the pavement, figured out who those folks were, and was able to talk to them about why this was very important for small groups and why it was very important for states to be able to determine the size of their small group. Who do you think in this situation with the Senate Help Committee Lower Healthcare Cost Act, who do you think, Chris, could possibly be a hold to prevent this from going forward?
I think in the Senate side, you're looking at people possibly like Rand Paul, who believe that this might be more government intervention than the government should get involved in when it comes to the issue of surprise billing, that that's really a dispute between two independent parties and not should be the role of the federal government. So there's definitely people like that. I also think people who feel very strongly that the bill should be an arbitration-based bill, something that we feel would make the whole system more expensive, but is generally the position of the providers, the doctors, the anesthesiologists, the emergency room physicians out there who prefer arbitration over this sort of benchmark rate, which is if you're not in network, you will get paid the average in-network rate back to you. For example, if you look at emergency room doctors right now, an emergency room doctor who's not inside the network charges 800% of Medicare for your charges there. When they're in network, they tend to get about 300% of Medicare. NAHU has been advocated for in the past that they would get 125% of Medicare. But you can see how this process can increasingly get very expensive. And when we talk about in healthcare that health insurance is expensive from healthcare is expensive, you can really see that it's in this process. That if you stay out of health insurance, you're kind of getting 800% of Medicare. Or in network, you get 350% of it. And Medicare is only paying obviously 100% of Medicare, you see how this can get increasingly expensive for the private sector very quickly.
The other major healthcare item this week was the oral arguments in the Fifth Circuit appeals case of Texas v. U.S. challenging the constitutionality of the ACA's individual mandate and the law itself. That decision is not expected to be released until later this year, but what can we interpret from the oral arguments this week?
Marcy, why don't you start off with explaining what the case is about and where it came from?
Sure. This is the Texas v. U.S. case that we've talked about for about a year now, where the plaintiffs are challenging the constitutionality of the individual mandate because of actions taken in 2017 by Congress in that big tax bill at the end of the year that zeroed out the individual mandate penalties. And so the plaintiffs are saying that as a penalty, if this is zeroed out, then it's no longer really a tax and it's a true mandate and therefore is unconstitutional. They are citing this because of the 2012 Supreme Court ruling that upheld the individual mandate because they said it was a tax and not a true mandate. And now that this is zeroed to $0 as a tax or penalty, the plaintiffs here are saying that this now falls against the ruling of the Supreme Court and is a true tax. So we saw earlier this year a decision by the lower court that decided in favor of the plaintiffs, and they agreed that this is a true mandate and is not a tax because no money is being levied. There's no penalty here. And the other piece of this is that the lower court also agreed with the plaintiffs that because the individual mandate was unconstitutional, that the rest of the law, the rest of the ACA, was also unconstitutional because the individual mandate was such a big part of making the rest of the ACA work that if the individual mandate was unconstitutional, then everything else in the ACA had to go with it. So that means things like coverage for pre-existing conditions, guaranteed issue, staying on your parents' plan until age 26, closing the Medicare donut hole, Medicaid expansion, all of those things would go along. So this is the decision of the lower court. We fast forward a couple of months and we're at our present time here in July. And this week at the appellate court, we had oral arguments. This case is being defended by Democrats that are members of the House of Representatives, members of Congress, and Democrat attorneys general from across the country. And there was an extra barrier that they had to overcome here. And this is because the appellate court, they were questioning the ability for the Democratic state attorneys general to defend this law and the ability of the House Democrats to stand up and defend this law, because technically the plaintiffs are suing the U.S., the Department of Justice, which is represented by the Trump administration. And as we've seen over the past several months and year, the Trump administration has said that they are not going to defend this, that the Department of Justice is not going to stand in. And so the appellate court asked whether the Democrat state attorneys general and Democrats in the House had standing, what they call standing, to actually defend this. And so what it means to have standing is that in this case that they would have to prove they would come under some type of harm or be injured by this going forward, by this law being enacted. And so the Democrats' attorneys general said that their states would be harmed because this would affect the federal funding that was going to their states, but it would also harm the individuals in their states, those that are receiving subsidies, those that have benefited from the ACA, and so therefore they have standing. We did not get a ruling from the appellate court on this. They went ahead and took briefs from the defendants to prove that they had standing, and then they opened it up for oral arguments. The judges on this panel are important. This is a three-judge panel, two of which were appointed by Republican presidents, one by President George W. Bush and the other by President Trump. And then the third judge was appointed by Jimmy Carter. The two Republican appointees seemed particularly skeptical when looking at the intent of Congress, looking at that 2017 tax bill that zeroed out the individual penalty. The Republican judges were looking at this and they were not convinced by the defendants that Congress had intended to keep the rest of the law in place when they eliminated the penalty. So the Republican judges are saying that Congress in 2017, when they zeroed out the individual mandate penalty, knew what they were doing, knew that this would invalidate the ACA, and that's why they passed it. And keep in mind, this is looking at the intent of the 2017 Congress. This is also the Congress that couldn't get repeal and replace passed. But this is also not the Congress that wrote the ACA. That would be the intent of Congress in 2010. And this is a different body.
So, Marcy, you're saying the law that the Republican Congress and Donald Trump signed is what's actually making the ACA possibly unconstitutional?
Yes. So they are looking at the intent when Congress passed the law to zero out the individual mandate penalty in that big tax bill that had a whole lot of other things in it, but not a full repeal. And keep in mind, this Congress never was able to pass a full repeal, not in the House and not in the Senate. But the Republican judges here are saying that Congress understood that by signing off on this one piece in this huge tax bill, that they understood that they were going to repeal the ACA by doing this. Another reason why this is of interest, and there is kind of a different spin on having this in the appellate court, is because in May, the Trump administration came out with a few statements on this court case. So we knew previously that the Trump administration had instructed the Department of Justice not to defend this. But then the Department of Justice also in May came out with a few different statements, one of which saying that because the plaintiffs are being represented by Republican attorneys general, so across the states, that the Department of Justice believed that the ruling in this case should only apply in the states where the Republican attorneys general were being represented in the court case, which is 18 states. So they're basically saying if this strikes down the ACA, if it strikes down the individual mandate, the Department of Justice, their opinion is that this would only be lawful in those 18 states that have a Republican attorney general that has signed on as a plaintiff in this lawsuit, which is different than the interpretation that we saw earlier when this was in the lower court, which was that this would apply across the board. So there were some conversations from the bench, from the judges hearing this, asking about exactly how that plan would work. And they didn't really get an answer from the attorney from the Justice Department. His answer was, a lot of work needs to get sorted out and it's complicated. But I think having this go into place in different ways in different states would obviously be very detrimental to market stability. We are already in a market where states can do very different things. And it was actually some of the Republican proposals that we saw in the last congressional session. Some of them would have allowed states to decide whether they wanted to keep the ACA or change it a little bit or do something different within their borders. So it almost seems like they're trying to get to that end by the Department of Justice releasing this position in their brief. Although keep in mind, it is not binding on the courts.
Marcy, what do you see the timeline going forward from the appellate court and possibly the Supreme Court?
Sure. So moving forward, the appellate court has stated that it is going to take them several months to come out with a decision. I don't think any of us are surprised by this. And in October of 2019, the Supreme Court is going to choose their docket for the 2019-2020 session for them. And I don't think that we're going to have a decision by then. What that means, and regardless of what the decision comes out of the appellate court, this is expected to be appealed, which then would go to the appellate court. If they miss that October deadline, it means that they won't be able to get onto the docket until 2020-2021, which obviously, if we're pushed back that far and they're setting, remember, they set their docket in October, this would mean that they would accept it onto their docket in October of 2020 and hear it sometime before July of 2021. Obviously, in November of 2020, we have an election. So this is all being propped up against an election when we look at the timeline. It is important to point out that even though the Trump administration has instructed the Department of Justice that they're not defending this law, and the Department of Justice has come out with that position about it only applying in certain states, which has been very confusing, it is important to point out that the administration has said that they will comply with the stay that was put into place by the lower court. And the stay, what that means is that the law will stay the law until there is a final decision by the highest court. And so the appellate court has also agreed that that is in the best interest of the market and the country. And so if we do see the appellate court agreeing with the lower court, we would expect that they would again stay the ruling and the ACA would stay the law of the land until we have a final decision by the Supreme Court. There is also an argument. Senator Murphy from Connecticut has pointed out that this case, if it's successful, he says, would result in a humanitarian catastrophe in this country because the plaintiffs in this case, backed by the Trump administration, are arguing that the court should throw out the entire ACA with nothing to replace it. And there are other people who have pointed out that when it talks about legal precedent, directs courts, even the lower courts, to limit damage to major statutes when considering which provisions to throw out, and that they should maintain everything they can that can stand on its own. So remember that the courts are looking at this. This is a statute, so they're looking at the constitutionality of the statute. And when they look at that, the legal review, the lens that they should be looking at that through is how to limit damages and how to preserve as much as they can that was passed by an earlier Congress when they're interpreting this in the court system. So we still have a long way to go. It was also pointed out in oral arguments and by the judges who asked, you know, can't Congress act now to do something to change this? Yes, if they acted tomorrow and passed and either put into place provisions that are the same as the ACA or put in some stopgap measures or even put the penalty to $1 so that it would have a monetary amount. Any of those actions could kind of stop this case from going forward. But the fact is, Congress hasn't acted. And it's interesting that they're not looking at the inactivity and intent of Congress to try to act to do that now, but they are looking at the congressional intent of 2017 of passing a tax bill that had this one provision related to the ACA and saying that by zeroing out the individual mandate penalty that Congress intended to completely repeal the ACA, even though, again, that Congress did nothing to pass a full repeal. So, like I said, we'll be continuing to watch this, and there have been questions about the fact that the Trump administration is willing to continue to implement this law under the stays of the court, because it is a choice by the Department of Justice to be able to continue to comply with this. So my prediction, at least another year, and I don't think we will have any changes to the market or to plans as a result of this court case. We could have changes as a result of other things, but I don't think that we'll have any changes to the market or plan designs based on this court case until possibly plan year 2022.
The Trump administration recently released a request for information on improving the ACA's Section 1332 state waivers, and NAHU submitted feedback with several suggestions. What were some of these proposals that NAHU offered, and how could they help the marketplaces, states, and consumers?
So we put together a group of NAHU members from across the country, from states that either already had a 1332 waiver approved or have gone through the process and possibly gotten all the way up to the end of the process and not been approved, and then those that are in ongoing efforts to try to get something passed in their states. And so we discussed the request for information that came out from the Trump administration and basically had four main points that we suggested to them on their request. And the intent of the RFI was to solicit ideas and encourage additional thinking and innovation as states consider developing Section 1332 waiver plans. And again, these waivers are those that allow states to waive certain provisions of the ACA as long as they're covering about the same amount of people for about the same cost with about the same type of plans covering the same types of benefits that are provided for under the ACA. So one of the suggestions that we had was to assist populations that fall into the family glitch. And these are families where the employer-based coverage often meets the Affordable Care Act affordability safe harbor. So the one member of the family who may be offered employer-sponsored coverage, their offer of coverage meets that 9.5% affordability standard, but the employer isn't required to offer that same affordability standard to the spouse and dependents. And because of that, the spouse could be offered employer-sponsored coverage because of the one that is employed by that employer, but the employer can charge the full amount of that coverage. Unfortunately, when we look at the affordability standard, that spouse that is not employed by the employer, even though they're being charged the full amount of their health insurance in this hypothetical situation, they can't go to the exchange and show them their family income and try to get a subsidy based on that, because the affordability will go back and test the affordability of the member of the family, that spouse, that it is the employee receiving the employer-sponsored coverage. And again, in this hypothetical, at the affordable rate. So we did suggest that exploring ideas of using waivers to provide premium assistance to individuals who wish to cover dependents on employer-sponsored plans, possibly by leveraging both employer-provided premium contributions and federal subsidy funds. Another point we raised was allowing the use of Section 1332 waivers in plan design. This is already something that they can do, but we pointed out some different areas within plan design, looking at even the rules regarding essential health benefit requirements, things like requiring pediatric dental and vision coverage that can often be issues, and the fact that the current regulatory structure doesn't match the way many businesses and individual consumers wish to purchase their coverage. And so states should be able to provide consumer-friendly changes that would reduce prices but still cover the type of benefits that would be in line with the ACA. The third point that we brought up is to provide more direct opportunities for policymakers and stakeholders from different states to meet and discuss potential waiver ideas. Oftentimes, and this is something that we bring up in our fourth point, so I'll kind of wrap these two together. And our fourth point was the hurdles that states currently experience when crafting and applying for Section 1332 waivers. Oftentimes, these hurdles are financial, the inability for states to be able to finance things like actuarial studies that are required by the 1332 waivers. And by allowing opportunities for policymakers from different states to meet and discuss these ideas, this would be a great way for states to possibly share in some of those hurdles and some of those financial restraints that are really preventing some states from moving forward. It would also allow some states to be able to better explore the possibility of doing regional exchanges or a regional 1332 waiver. This is something that's already allowed, is for states to come together and apply for 1332 waivers, or even for states to apply for a 1332 waiver that is applicable only in certain counties or areas of their state. In some cases, it could be counties that may spill over into a neighboring state with counties that are in that same area from that neighboring state to create an area that would benefit from a specific type of 1332 waiver, thinking of some of these rural areas that might be on the borders between two states. So by allowing these opportunities for states to get together, it would allow for states to be able to benefit from each other's ideas, but also to identify some of these areas where they could work together to then overcome many of the hurdles to actually be able to benefit from applying for and receiving a 1332 waiver.
Looking ahead to what's on tap, the House is expected to hold a vote next week on the bipartisan bill to fully repeal the ACA's Cadillac tax. NAHU has long advocated a full repeal of this tax and has been a leading proponent of the delays previously signed into law. How is this vote different from all the others, and what does it mean for the Cadillac tax moving forward?
So knock on wood, we will be voting on repeal of the Cadillac tax next week in the House of Representatives. We've not heard for sure. As of Wednesday, I do not have a date yet, but it is definitely happening this month. This is different than any other time before because this is a clear repeal of the Cadillac tax. This is not a one-year delay. This is not a two-year delay. This is an actual complete repeal of the Cadillac tax being passed as a standalone bill. It is not being packaged with some larger healthcare vehicle. It is being put on the House floor to be repealed, and there's no offset. There's no paying for this tax. And so we're very excited to see this go through. Once we have a date, we're going to be contacting all our members so that you can contact your member of Congress, ask them to vote yes on passing and repeal of the Cadillac tax. We're looking forward to an overwhelmingly bipartisan vote. The bill has over 358 co-sponsors on it right now, and so we think that we can have a really strong vote bringing this over to the Senate and finally getting this Cadillac tax off the books. Even though the Cadillac tax has never come into place, we're seeing the detrimental effect onto the health insurance market already. One of the things we've definitely seen are higher deductibles as everyone starts preparing for the Cadillac tax to come into place. So I'm excited to see this bill finally get to the House floor and some progress being made on the Cadillac tax and not just a Band-Aid put on the situation.
And one thing I'll add to that is when Chris says that we have 358 co-sponsors signed on to this bill, NAHU does recognize that this gives us extras, so to speak. However, just because someone has signed on to co-sponsor a bill doesn't mean necessarily that once it gets to the floor, that vote is secure on that bill. Oftentimes, we also have representatives who don't show up for floor votes. So that can also kind of dig into that extra authority that we have. So it's very important when we send out these messages and our operation shouts that you participate in the operation shout, retweet, like anything that you see from us on Facebook. Make sure you're messaging your members of Congress. We don't want to take for granted that additional buffer that we have. It would be great if we had all 358 voting in favor of the full repeal, but we, like I said, don't want to take any numbers for granted and would appreciate all of your help to really make sure that we push this over the House floor line and over to the Senate.
It's now time for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hours Toast of the Week. What are we toasting to this week?
This week, we are toasting to Chairman Pallone and Ranking Member Walden of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. As John mentioned earlier, their bipartisan support of the surprise billing bill in the House has really been able to allow this issue to gain traction and support from both sides of the aisle, and their bipartisan leadership on this has just been invaluable. Cheers!
Thank you for joining us for this week's installment of the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NAHU's government affairs efforts, or to join as a member of NAHU, visit nahu.org.